And now, two pigeons bemoaning the fact you can stream DirecTV satellite-free.
You see this?
A family watching baseball on DirecTV with no satellite dish in sight.
Let's heckle them.
You call that changing the channel?
Choke up on the remote, buddy!
I hope getting all these games on DirecTV makes up for your mother not pre-chewing your sunflower seeds!
DirecTV has the most MLB games. Call 1-800-DIRECTV. Claim based on total games carried on sports networks. Sports availability varies by zip code and requires choice package. Terms and restrictions apply.
As you've probably heard by now, we've teamed up with BetMGM this season. We'll be using BetMGM lines to make all of our picks, and we'll have special offers for our listeners each week. If you haven't signed up for BetMGM yet, use bonus code THEATHLETIC, and you'll get a one-year subscription to The Athletic, plus up to a $1,500 first bet offer on your first wager with BetMGM. Here's how it works. Download the BetMGM app and sign up using bonus code THEATHLETIC. Make your first deposit of at least $10. Place your first bet on any game and claim your voucher for a one-year subscription to The Athletic. See BetMGM.com for terms. U.S. promotional offers not available in D.C., Mississippi, New York, Nevada, Ontario, or Puerto Rico. Gambling problem? Call 1-800-GAMBLER. Available in the U.S. Call 877-8-HOPE-NY or text HOPE-NY 467-369 in New York. Call 1-800-NEXT-STEP in Arizona. 1-800-327-5050 in Massachusetts. 1-800-BETS-OFF in Iowa. 1-800-270-7117 for confidential help in Michigan. 1-800-981-0023 in Puerto Rico. First bet offer for new customers only in partnership with Kansas Crossing Casino and Hotel. Don't forget, if you haven't signed up for BetMGM yet, use bonus code THEATHLETIC and you'll get a one-year subscription to The Athletic, plus up to a $1,500 first bet offer on your first wager.
The race is on, and while Formula One is deep into the August break, there's still plenty going on with talk of Ferrari engine upgrades and arguments about accident damage, as well as the opportunity to take a look at the technical development war that has raged through the season so far. I'm Ed Straw, and joining me to offer their unique insights are Mark Hughes and Gary Anderson. Well, hello, Mark. Enjoying your August break?
I am, yes. The weather's nice. Been getting out on the bike sometimes, and been doing a lot of podcasting, actually.
Yeah, there's a lot. We just can't stop talking. That's the problem. So, if you run out of voice towards the end of this one, that would be understandable. And Gary, from what you've just been saying, it doesn't sound like you're having much of a break. You've got all sorts of projects on the go.
Oh, I've always got a few projects. Yeah, I started to rebuild my old 1927 Erskine T50 Tour. I've had it for about 8 or 9 years now and haven't done much to it. It all runs okay, but it's time to sort of start working on it. So I've been stripping down the wheels and getting the wooden spokes out of them and taking the paint off them. Somebody painted them grey. I want them back to wood. So, but fairly marathon task to get to the spokes, to be honest, I have to say. But it's interesting. Different engineering altogether, but actually quite impressive engineering when you think it was 1927.
Yeah, very much going into the relatively early days, I guess there. So an interesting little part. I presume you haven't really dealt with cars of that age before.
No, not really. Nearly as old as me, or I'm nearly as old as it, whatever you like to call it. But, you know, whenever you think it's almost 100 years ago, you know, the detail in the engineering is quite impressive. So, for what it is, I'm very keen to get into it and sort of understand it a little bit more.
Well, we expect you to have it up and running on F1 timelines. Now you've probably committed to it. So you've got a few months and then you'll be behind if not. So we'll keep track of that. But there's plenty to talk about, as we said. So, Mark, should we start off with Ferrari? We know they've got some power unit upgrades after the break. What can you tell us about what it has planned?
Yeah, well, Matteo Binotto surprised us a little bit by that announcement. We did a little interview, sort of just talking about the half season and just giving a sort of summary to a few of us. And he let slip that, yeah, they will be introducing a completely, well, not completely, but a new spec of power unit. So when they introduced the 2021 power unit, they don't tell you which of the elements that you're allowed to change have been changed. So the six, there's the ICE, there's the turbo, the ERS H, the ERS K, the electronics, and the battery. And they're all elements which can be changed once, upgraded once. We know pretty much that the internal combustion engine, and specifically the combustion chamber, was changed with the engine that's been run so far, but we don't know which of the other ones were changed. So this was really just confirmation that they didn't change all of them, that some of those elements were the same as the 2020 engine, so they could still have that ability to upgrade them in the next engine, which will be post-summer break. It's a sort of bit of a complication with the engine of Charles Leclerc, if indeed the one that he was involved in the accident in Hungary is dead, because it means that it sort of got run on complications of if it has to take the third engine early to replace that one, and it's of the new spec, that's his three engines for the season, and we've still got half the season to go. So yes, it's it presents some logistical challenges, I'm sure, but it's also quite interesting in that he seemed to be quite confident that it was a significant performance upgrade, and we've seen them cut into a big deficit that they had last year from that transition to the 2021 engine. It's a lot closer on power than last year's engine was, though it's still significantly off. And he talked about how far off they were in that half season to date, and it's by his calculation it's 7/10. By mine it's a bit less than that, but even whatever, he was saying he assessed it as 60% power unit, 40% chassis, that deficit. So this is a significant chunk of that 60% we're talking about. So it'd be very interesting to monitor the Ferrari's performance when it gets that new PU in it.
And I guess, Gary, with the stakes being so high, because they need to get their power unit package up to scratch by the time the final homologations are done, that the last bits can be done on September the 1st, 2022. And then that's your lot for the following 3 years. So will that be a good indication of whether Ferrari is indeed on the right track with its power unit development?
Yeah, I think it will be, to be honest. You know, it's a very fine line between understanding where your power unit deficit is and your chassis deficit is. And that 60-40% is a nice number to sort of head into, I suppose. I'm not quite sure that I see that quite as black and white, to be honest, because you've got to make sure that one doesn't affect the other. I mean, you can aerodynamically make the car better by just running the cooling, less cooling, for example, but that affects the engine. So it's never just quite as black and white as that. But again, all these things about homologating the engines and what you're allowed to change this year prior to next season is always very confusing, because we never quite get to the underneath it all to understand what they're actually trying to achieve with it. You know, the normally aspirated engine is just one large unit, and there's a huge amount of work you can do inside of there as far as combustion is concerned and, you know, just general design. But outside of that, then it's about deploying the energy you've got and harnessing the energy you're generating. So there's also a huge amount you can do there. So if they can find 25 horsepower, maybe 30 horsepower as a given sort of flat line at power advantage, then I think it'll put them in line with you know, the big end, the top boys. So yeah, it will be an indication. And we're going to circuits where horsepower is an important part. You know, Spa, Monza, these sort of circuits, they don't, horsepower definitely is a dividend. And obviously for Ferrari, I think they'd like to show better in Monza this year than they did last year. So it's a big push for that, I'm pretty sure. So interesting to see when they do introduce this engine and how hard they can run it, you know, initially. But it should be an indication for the next 3 years as to where we're heading with it.
Yeah, the strategy for the timing is quite complicated, because as well as the Leclerc problem, Sainz had a new power unit on Saturday in Hungary, didn't he? So he's kind of drifting into the set to have a penalty at some point. I think they're both, as it stands, potentially have an MGUK they can still introduce, but it depends. We don't know what damage there is from the Leclerc. So it's difficult, isn't it? Because you'd think Monza would be a great place to do it, but then you're going to get grid penalties.
I think it would all be very interesting, to be honest, if all the teams would agree to do their penalties at the same race meeting. You know, because I'm sure before the season's out, everybody will have to suffer some penalty somewhere. So it'd be great to see it all, and then suddenly that would give the FIA a bit of a headache to work out the grid.
That's like those easy boarding tickets where early boarding where you pay ten or more to get on. I always think it would be great if you just got all the passengers together and just said, "Let's all buy a ticket," and then let's all complain because we're not the first on.
I must admit, Gary, you've sat in a lot of technical meetings. I'd quite like to see the response you'd have got if you'd proposed that. I imagine you'd have created some great arguments.
Well, I know, as you say, everybody wants to get the upper hand on everybody else, but just from a spectator point of view, it'd be good to see how it would unfold, to be honest. But yeah, I don't think anybody would ever agree to anything as silly as that. But, you know, it would be a way of demonstrating the fact that, you know, three engines for the season, the 23 race season, is pretty heavy going, to be honest. It's pretty tough for anybody to achieve that. So it might be a way of demonstrating to the FIA the powers to be that maybe it would be better to have four engines for the season or something of that nature. But who am I to question that?
Yeah, a little bit of margin might make life a little bit easier. Well, I'm sure we'll touch on Ferrari in this next section. But Gary, you've been looking in detail at the performance patterns across the end of last year and then this year. So which teams have impressed you most in terms of the gains made, and also which ones have impressed you the least, I guess?
Yeah, I mean, it's always difficult because we're, 11 races into the season. There's another 12 to go, probably. So it's always difficult to see who came out best between the end of last season and this season. You know, as we know, the cars were theoretically more or less the same. Aerodynamic developments were allowed, and then the regulations for the floor, brake ducts, etc., were instigated. So the teams had to react to that more than anything else. And I think, you know, whenever you look at it, over the winter, Red Bull did make some steps. But at the end of last season, they weren't that far away from Mercedes. So last year, Mercedes said they stopped development on the 2020 car very early so they could concentrate on the 2021 changes. And basically, you know, they went backwards. They're just about the only team. Them and Aston Martin and Haas all went backwards that little bit whenever it came to their relative performance at the start of 2021. So there was a big uproar then about the high rate cars, the low rate cars, and how the FIA had scuppered Mercedes and Aston Martin with their pink Mercedes. So, you know, that was how the season started. Everybody else made slight improvements on their relative performance, but, you know, top of the pile come the first race of 2021 was Red Bull. But it didn't continue like that. You know, that's the thing about it. And if you look, you know, coming through to now, again, Red Bull haven't gone forward. They've been competitive at a lot of places, but they haven't developed their way forward, and you know, Mercedes have. So Mercedes have reacted to that situation and overcome some of their losses. I think, you know, whenever we look at it, we talked about how you would go about developing the new cars, the cars for 2021, and I put a lot of emphasis into making that front corner of the underfloor work harder, the barge board area and that front corner of the floor, because the whole underfloor is one unit, and there's a low pressure underneath that big flat floor area, sucking the car down onto the ground. It doesn't really care where the diffuser is. It doesn't really care whether the diffuser is at the back of it or the side of it or where it is. You just want to accelerate the airflow as fast as you can underneath that floor. And if you can, you know, accommodate it by having these two sort of front corner side diffusers with all that barge board kit scavenging airflow out from underneath the floor, it means that the rear diffuser doesn't have quite as much work to do for the whole underfloor to have the same depth of low pressure under it. So some teams got their direction sorted out in that very early. I think AlphaTauri would be the one I'd sort of point at and say they definitely got onto that situation quite quickly. And McLaren. And Mercedes didn't. So their update for Silverstone was more in that area, to try and make the whole underfloor work as one and not rely on the diffuser quite so much. But so, you know, they have moved forward now whenever we look at the average performance. Ferrari, I mean, we talked about Ferrari there a little bit about their engine, and the average of their last four races of last year, Ferrari were 0.9% off being the best. And actually, if you take away Red Bull, who was the best, Ferrari were end up being 0.8% off the ultimate pace. If you look at it right now, Ferrari are 0.8% off the ultimate pace. But again, Red Bull aren't perfect. They're the best. So Ferrari are now 0.7%. So the difference in that, you know, 6 tenths, 7 tenths, 8 tenths of a second or whatever it is, if you take all the races so far this year, as I say, Ferrari are about, were about 0.8% off the end of last year, and they're now 0.7% off last year. They're more competitive, but they're more competitive, I think, because others have not done as good a job as opposed to them being that much more competitive. They've gained the fraction, but they haven't gained as much as it, you know, as it looks. It isn't just a light switch job. They haven't gone forward as much. But in general, you know, it's a bit sort of nip and tuck with the teams. As I say, Red Bull haven't improved over this season so far. Ferrari have actually lost a fraction over the season so far. AlphaTauri have lost a fraction over the season so far. Alpine have lost a fraction over the season so far. And the rest of them have gained a little bit over the season so far. So it's, but again, it's, you know, it's that 0.1%. There's nothing too dramatic in there. And it is about getting the underflow to work harder. That's the most important thing because of the regulation changes with this trimming the sides of the floor.
Yeah, and the other point, I guess, with Ferrari is they've maybe given away a sliver of single-lap performance to help their tyre management over the year. And obviously, when we're talking about performance here, it's single-lap qualifying pace because that's the most steady set of data we can use. So, yeah, it's interesting. Well, one team, Mark, that has been quite interesting is McLaren because we've seen quite a lot of tweaks on the McLaren, various different versions of the wider bargeboard package. They seem to be a team that has a pretty good handle on where they need to go these days. When you consider the disarray they were in a few years ago, I think it probably does speak well of how far they've come, doesn't it?
Yeah, it does. And the fact that they've gone their own way in so many directions, the diffuser's a little bit different to everybody else's, their rear wings are slightly different configuration to most, and their developments are gone in a different direction. It suggests they're on their own path. They're not just blindly following what everybody else is doing, and while they're doing that, they're coming up with a car that's regularly the best of the rest, and it sometimes has even been able to challenge, like we saw in Austria, it was able to even challenge the front two in qualifying at least. It has a very big DRS boost. I think that was the what was behind that particular track suiting it so well. Because so much of the percentage of that lap at the Red Bull Ring is DRS and qualifying. But even so, it's yes, I think that's probably, for me, outside of the top two, I think the McLaren has been the most interesting and most intriguing one.
It's an interesting point there you mentioned about the DRS boost. I don't think we've talked about this on podcasts really before, so it's worth Gary addressing. We do see different levels of DRS efficiency, drag reduction across the different teams. Obviously, the aperture that's open, it's the same size for everyone. Can you just explain why we do see differences in terms of the performance gain relative to each other that they get, depending on the DRS zones and the track sensitivities and the car characteristics?
Well, part of it really is obviously the rear wing design itself. If you've got a longer main plane, for example, and a shorter flap, you will theoretically be able to generate more downforce when it's shut. But when it's open, you'll lose less drag because the airflow is still attached to the main plane profile. And that's acting like a wing in its own right, I suppose you could call it. So if you've got a slightly longer flap and a shorter main plane by just a little bit, even though the gap between the two is the same, you will reduce the drag by more, but you won't be able to generate the downforce that the other one would do when it's closed. So it's a balance in that between the two. It's about what downforce you want to have when the DRS isn't in use and what drag you want to reduce it when the DRS is in use. And some tracks, as Mark just said, Austria, for example, it's, you know, the slow corners are always fast, but there's a majority of slow corners there between fast straights. So, you know, you link that up and you find you can make more ground if you have more drag reduction when the DRS is open, and you don't lose quite as much whenever it's closed. So It's a balance in that between the circuit characteristics, and it's a balance in that between what the team believes in as well. You know, so it's always difficult. Again, you can have run into problems with the rear wing reattaching when it's shut. If you have too big a too short a main plane and too big a flap. So again, it's the philosophy that the teams go through. It's just a balancing act between one thing and another.
And of course, the DRS will remain a thing next year. It's in the 2022 rules, although the hope is that in the longer term it can be dropped if those regulations work as hope. But yeah, development war has been interesting so far. It's going to wind down a bit in the second half of the season, but there still should be plenty to come after the August break. Well, Mark, we've looked a lot at what's been going on track, but let's go into the virtual world. Something we've been very used to in Formula One over the past couple of decades, driver-in-loop simulators. Alfa Romeo on the brink of being able to use their system, which was acquired in 2019, as a proper tool for development now after spending some time working on the correlation. Ferrari have got their new state-of-the-art simulator housed in a new building that's going to be focused on 22 development after the break. So how important do you think tools like this will be for the 2022 cars, given currently all of the modelling and behaviour is effectively theoretical, isn't it? Because there's no real-world cars to correlate to.
Yeah, it's absolutely a crucial point, and it's a big reason why Sauber or Alfa or whatever they have been over the years has fallen back. Because in that period when they were most starved of investment, when they almost went out of business. Before the current owners came in, that was when everybody was really ramping up the resource on driver and loop simulators because of the advantages that it gives. But it doesn't just instantly switch on and give you an advantage. It has to be worked on for a very, very long time. And Alfa were, you know, they were saying that basically last year they, because of all the challenges, all the economic challenges, they just didn't even look at it. It was basically not used, even though they had it there physically. So yes, it's going to be interesting to see how much that brings now they're bringing it online. And Ferrari sort of looking at generation two of theirs, and because isn't everything, the technology is moving on all the time, and it's getting better and better. So yeah, they're quite confident that there's a lot to be found in theirs, which is not going to be used at all for this year's car. It's purely for the 2022 onwards.
The thing about it really, Ed, is that the simulator, the tool is just a tool. It's all about the data you can feed into it, and I think for anybody that's just switching the machine on, it takes a long time to get confidence in the tool. And it can lead you down the garden path just as much as anything. For example, the new tires, the 18-inch rims, the different sidewall, the characteristics. Not only just the stiffness of that, but the characteristics with steering lock are going to be completely different. How the tire flexes, you know, we see it on TV now, the amount of movement you get on the tread laterally whenever the car, you know, is loaded up. And you know, all that is part of that simulation tool. If you get it 100%, fantastic. But it's so difficult to model all that stuff. And to be honest, even now, I don't think any team does model it to the level. The deflection of the rear tire and the diffuser area makes such a massive difference to how the diffuser works with that movement. We've seen for years, you know, with the current cars connecting the diffuser sides up to the sort of low pressure behind the rear tire increases the performance of the diffuser. The thing is, the rear tire is not in that position all the time, especially whenever it's loaded up laterally. And also next year with the 18-inch rims, the rear tire is going to be in a different position again. So very, very difficult until you really get some real track data and some correlation data to actually make some use of it, I think. Even it doesn't matter who you are. If you're Ferrari, it's still going to be the same task.
And even when it comes to the tires, although most of the teams have been testing them this year on their mule cars, they generally don't know what they're testing. So you can perhaps get some very general characteristics, but it's going to be really, really vague. So I guess that's the interesting point. Mark, remember when the 2014 cars were coming in with the the V6 turbo hybrid engines. I remember people talking about driving it in the simulators and coming up with all sorts of weird and wonderful things you might do with gear selection, etc. And of course, once the real cars run, it's much more conventional. So I guess it does show how kind of experimental you can get when you're trying to learn about these cars digitally, effectively.
Yeah, it's like anything at the very beginning of the learning process. You have an almost infinity of possibilities, and very quickly narrows down to what the most productive path is, and then you get working on just extracting the most from a smaller margin, and it all becomes much more intricate. It's just like any new technology. That's how the advances tend to happen. That tends to be the pattern.
Yeah, and it's interesting. We're starting to hear a few drivers giving a little bit of feedback about the experimental 22 stuff they've done, but I don't think anyone's really got too thorough an idea at this stage, but they will as the year goes on. Well, obviously, the simulator, we can connect to our next topic, because it's drivers adapting, and obviously the simulator, driving loop simulator, is one of the tools for that, Gary. But it's been a really big talking point this season, hasn't it? Been drivers adapting to new cars after moving teams. See, Daniel Ricciardo's the big talking point. We talked about him quite a bit on our last podcast, but it hasn't always been this way, has it? So why is it proving to be so difficult? Are the cars really so esoteric and specific today compared to, I don't know, 20 years ago?
Yeah, I think the cars have got more and more developed in a direction to suit their driver, a driver, whatever you like to call it. I mean, Fernando Alonso has just been talking about some of his characteristics that he likes from the car. And the fact that we've always seen Fernando with a steering wheel, he turns the car in very abruptly and puts quite a lot of steering lock on it. And then he feels the front end from that tire. And if the front end gets lighter, then he knows the car's understeering. And if the front end gets heavier, he's ready for the rear end stepping out. He's done that all his sort of career. A lot of other drivers, if you ask them, and I have asked drivers, how do you know the car's understeering? A lot of them don't. You know, it's when the load on their shoulder would reduce. I mean, I remember Eddie Irvine, we built a steering rack that had rising rate in it, so that basically, you know, for the fast corners, you just had to turn it a little bit. But then for the slower corners, you didn't have to turn it as much because the rate rose. And as far as he was concerned, that was less understeer. But it was only because he had more steering lock on the car. So, you know, it's very, very difficult how a driver perceives what the car is doing. I think we're seeing a good example of it this year with driver changes, because Daniel Ricciardo, you know, he got on top of things at Renault, but it took him a while, I suppose, at Renault to get on top of things. And he's now gone to McLaren, and he's struggling to get on top of it. You know, McLaren, we just talked about their performance, 99.9% of that has come from Lando Norris. Daniel's suffering because the car characteristics don't seem to suit him. But he's got all the data. He knows how Lando goes in on the brakes and turns the steering and does everything, you know, but he can't get himself just to copy that. It doesn't seem to work completely for him. So he needs to get the feeling in the car. And Fernando was saying about, you know, changing the steering rack and how the steering rack feel was there. Again, Kimi Raikkonen is another driver who really, really does concentrate a lot on the feeling of the steering. And whenever he started driving for Lotus, as it was then, you know, he spent a lot of time, or they spent a lot of time trying to change the steering rack characteristics to give him the feedback he needed. So it's all the subtle little details. And I think because everything has got so complicated, I suppose you might call it, how you drive the car, the characteristics of the regeneration, corner entry, you know, the braking, the rear axle being half electrical braking, half disc braking or whatever, or maybe even 75% electrical braking and 25% disc braking, and the front all being disc braking, and characteristics of temperature change on the discs on the front is a massive thing. Characteristics of temperature change on the rear is not. So there's a lot of things going on that have made the cars much more complicated to drive and to just get the car into the corner. Because you know, obviously when you're driving, go along a straight, you have to slow down to get into the corner. I think if you took any driver where there's just a nice, quick, like Cops Corner, for example, let's say, where you arrive at it, and you arrive and drive as such, nothing's really happening too big. I think that sort of corner is, most drivers could drive any car through there. But it's when you get the complicated car corners where you're recharging the battery pack, underbraking, and you're trying to turn it in on the brakes to keep the recharge as long as possible, all that sort of stuff. Then it becomes more and more complicated.
And it has been interesting to track the progress, Mark, because some of the other drivers who've moved, it took Vettel a little bit of time with the Aston Martin. He's still a little bit up and down, but his peaks have been pretty strong this year. Carlos Sainz adapted fairly well. So do we have to assume that the ease of adapting is kind of proportional to the how unusual the cars are, shall we say, that the McLaren is particularly unusual, or do we have to put the kind of focus on the driver and say, well, actually, say Sainz has done a much better job of adapting to the Ferrari than Ricciardo has to the McLaren, or, as always, is it a bit of both?
Yeah, I think it is a bit of both, and I think there is some truth in the fact that the McLaren is a slightly different car to the others in the pack. We referenced it earlier technically, but I think it's by all accounts, a little bit different in its characteristics as well. Carlos Sainz referenced it, and you know, he infamously bumped into Daniel and said, "What do you think? It's a bit different, eh?" And Daniel was saying, "Yeah, I wish you'd told me before." Ultimately it is down to the driver to adapt to the car, but there are varying degrees of difficulty in doing that. So when you say one driver's done it, so why can't the other? Well, the one driver who's done it, his task may have been slightly simpler. So you're not comparing like with like, probably.
So what do you do, Gary, if you're the technical director and you've got a driver who you know is good, but just isn't in tune with the car? How much of it is changing the car, how much of it is shaking some sense into the driver and getting them to do your bidding?
You get them by the throat, pin them against the garage wall and explain the facts of life to them.
It's motivational techniques. I like that.
Yeah, you have to accept that everybody's different. Yeah, that's step one. But, you know, to be honest, the guy that brings the return to you, as far as lap time's concerned, will always float to the top as far as listening to them and thinking about how you can make the car better in that set of characteristics. It's one of those sort of situations where, you know, you'll try your hardest for the other driver, but you won't give up your understanding of how you make the car faster just because the other driver isn't happy with the situation. I've had drivers say, oh, you know, when I drove for XYZ, you know, that their car did this or their car did that. And you have no real idea why, because you've got your own, you know, philosophy you're following down the road. Your driver that you work with has got his philosophy, he's bought into it. It's a bit like Verstappen and Red Bull. That seems to be the extreme out there, I think, where, you know, he buys into the fact of Adrian Newey generating the package that he does, or Adrian Newey and his people. And he's adapted to that philosophy, and Adrian's adapted to Verstappen's philosophy, and the both of them are going down the same path. So, you know, if somebody else comes in and can't do it, then it's really not the philosophy of the company to change direction. They need to adapt to it. And, you know, I think we're seeing Sergio Perez at the moment. I think he's brought some information to Red Bull. He's adapting to it reasonably well, but not as well as I would hope a professional, well-experienced driver would. And the same for Daniel Ricciardo. I think if you look at Carlos Sainz going into the Ferrari, you know, we've always said that Leclerc is seriously fast, especially on a qualifying lap. But Sainz is up there with him. So the Ferrari must be a reasonably benign car to do that. So, but at the end of the day, they're not winning races at the moment. So it's whenever they make their car to the level of being able to win races, will one of the two of those guys get left behind? It's only time will tell.
Yeah, I think in the case of Red Bull, I think Verstappen, like the greatest drivers tend to be, is very adaptable. So I suspect you could probably throw him in just about anything and he'd get on top of it relatively quickly. Although it's difficult to know because he's always driven Red Bull machines in Formula One. So yeah, interesting to see how things change next year when the regulations change. Well, Mark, all three of F1's biggest teams, Mercedes, Ferrari and Red Bull, have complained to a certain extent about the impact of accident damage under the cost cap. Ferrari and Red Bull in particular were suggesting that there could be some way to compensate them for it or give a cost cap exemptions for accident damage. This idea that a rival team that causes an accident should pay for damage done, which I imagine McLaren were pleased wasn't there for the 73 British Grand Prix with Jody Scheckter making short work of most of the field. But do you have any sympathy for this position?
It's only become an issue in the cost cap era when the big teams have, when the accident damage has prevented the big teams from being able to spend as much as they want on making the car go faster. For most of the teams on the grid, that's always been the case. It's always been the case that accident damage impacts upon the development budget. The big teams, the three big teams probably, were able to just not have that as a factor. They just spend more. And for the first time, they're having the same limitations as most of the teams on the grid have always had. So I think it's suddenly become an issue. But I think it's just something that you can't start adapting the cost cap regulations, which are hugely complex set of regulations which have taken years to implement, just because you've had some teams have had a sequence of accidents. And as Gunther Steiner at Haas said, has said, well, what happens if we have less accidents? Do we reduce the cost cap? So no, I think you just got to manage your way around it. I don't think we can start talking about having like insurance claims from one team to another and cost cap exemptions. I think it's already complicated enough. I think we just got to suck it up.
Yeah, I think it's a fairly ridiculous argument from the big teams as well, and actually it just reflects their own inability to manage it properly, because they've not had the discipline perhaps. And it's not as if they won't have gone into the season with a damage contingency. They'll had X amount of cash expected to spend, and what they want to do is pull back on some of that and throw that into car development or whatever. So yeah, very little sympathy. I imagine Gary is somebody who spent a reasonable chunk of your F1 career with smaller to middling teams budget wise. I imagine you were inundated with team bosses from bigger teams offering to pay for damage they'd done to your cars, weren't you?
No, not quite. But, at the end of the day, it's one of those sort of situations, as you say, you've got to build in a contingency plan for what your sort of normal accident damage would be. It does become a bit more difficult when you have a budget cap. And that budget cap, as Mark's just said, that budget cap probably affects 3-4 teams in the pit lane. And the other six, would just dream about having that much money anyway. So, they've always had a budget cap, so they've always had to work within it. And to be honest, 90% of the accidents, or maybe 80% of the accidents, happen to those smaller teams where they're inexperienced or inexperienced drivers. They're battling in the middle of the field. There's a lot less accidents up front, except for this year. I'm happy to say, because obviously this year's been a fairly vocal point up the front there with incidents and accidents, but. I don't think there's any way to standardise it. Maybe at the end of the day, each team should nominate the price of their chassis, so that you get Mercedes saying their chassis is worth £1 million, and you get whoever at Alfa Romeo saying their chassis is worth £300,000 or something, and then you find a nice happy compromise in there, and you say, okay, well, if you're the chassis are all, they've all got a chip in them, they're all nominated. If you have an accident that the stewards have decided was generated by another driver, then you can have this X amount of money on top of your budget cap, but you can't use that chassis again. So you have to use a new chassis, and we've averaged it out that the chassis cost 600,000, so you can have 600,000 on top of your budget cap. But it gets complicated, as Mark says, and it's one of those sort of situations where it would put a lot of pressure on the stewards to allocate blame to somebody. How do you allocate blame to that incident at Silverstone with Verstappen and Hamilton, whenever the stewards got holed up because they allocated blame to Hamilton, or the percentage of blame went to Hamilton for causing the accident? But it's a different deal altogether if you're allocating that blame relative to a huge financial sum as well. So it's not easy, and I think it's better to leave it alone.
Yeah, I'm sure the stewards wouldn't enjoy having to be insurance assessors on top of the rest of the stuff they have to do. That would make it quite interesting. But it's interesting you mentioned the chassis there, because I think the chassis are a really good example of where, particularly the big teams, all the teams really, have wanted to kind of save money, because for the most of the teams, they've carried over the chassis. So Mercedes and Red Bull are using chassis that were built last year, which wasn't covered by the cost cap. So there's things they want to do that they just don't want to have the extra outlay. So I think that's where it's rooted in, isn't it? It's the fact that they think, oh, we've got a few things we can save here, we might get through, and then you lose a chassis. And suddenly, yeah, that is going to take a six-figure sum out of your cost cap allocation.
Yeah, it is. It is a big impact. And it's also a big impact as far as manpower is concerned, and the manufacturing time of it. So It's the, you know, it's the same carbon people that will be making the chassis, that will be making front wings and bits and pieces like that. So if you suddenly need a new chassis because it's been written off, it can hurt further down the line with other stuff. So, yeah, using last year's chassis is important. I mean, next year is a clean sheet of paper in more ways than one, but it's a clean sheet of paper as far as the cars are concerned, as far as everything is concerned. So in reality, it's in the interests of all of the teams, and this includes the big teams, to manufacture their components as cheaply as possible. You know, step back on that material spec a little bit. Just, you know, just reduce the price of your chassis by 10, 15, 20% if you can. Because if you just go for the ultimate performance from the materials, because you can make it, you know, a kilogram or 2 kilograms lighter, then you can very easily then, you know, outspend your budget cap. So at the end of the day, it's a clean sheet of paper for a lot of reasons, performance-wise, everything, but and overtaking, but it's also a clean sheet of paper to not be caught up in this must spend as much as possible in the interest of performance. There is another thing to take into account there.
I guess, Mark, it also reflects the new facts of life for the big teams, doesn't it? Because there's all sorts of areas where they're having to cut back and do things more efficiently. They don't have the old advantage of it, which is kind of why my feeling is just that they just need to suck it up and deal with it as various smaller teams who haven't had a more disproportionate share of F1's revenue for 7 years or whatever it was under the last Concorde to help them. So it's just very hard to really share their frustration, isn't it?
Yeah, and it's interesting to listen to some of the top teams. Given this new constraint of the cost cap, their first reaction is, let's throw some people at how we most take the most efficient route through this cost cap, which is, you know, just incurring more expense in itself. But yeah, it's. I think it's just a bit of a reset, a brain reset for those teams that have traditionally been able to just chase performance and not have to think about anything else. But I'm sure they'll very quickly adapt.
I'm quite looking forward to the next time a Ferrari wipes someone out and someone from another team delivers an invoice to Mattia Binotto for it. So I think what goes around comes around sometimes on these things. But for our final topic, Gary, let's go back to the title fight. There's been plenty of talk about the Lewis Hamilton-Max Verstappen side, but it's also Mercedes versus Red Bull, isn't it? Adrian Newey recently talked of what he called behind-the-scenes politicking and lobbying against our car, a thinly veiled reference to the complaints about flexi wings, pit stop sensors and all manner of other things coming from the Mercedes side. I think in this case, you do have some sympathy with that position, don't you?
Yeah, I do have a lot of sympathy, to be honest. It's a sad thing to look at whenever you think that Mercedes, since 2014, have been, you know, the dominant team, the dominant car, the dominant drivers, the dominant everything. And nobody, I don't think anybody stepped up there and said, oh, well, you know, they're doing things that aren't right. There's no way they can get that power from the engine because we can't. They've just taken it on the chin and decided they've got to get on with it. And Red Bull's been one of those teams. So I think it's wrong now that Mercedes have been caught, let's say, by Red Bull. And everything, and every time that Red Bull actually get the advantage, which is very, very small, there's always a reason. You know, Bakau, for example, with the tire pressures. You know, they'd found a solution to running the tires lower. If it right, might be right, I don't know. But at the end of the day, it still seems to be that Mercedes want to point the finger at something that's making it wrong for them, like the start of the season when the regulations were changed to scupper the lower rate cars. But whenever Mercedes did introduce the sort of floor, more conventional floor design, front corner floor design, i.e. that, you know, AlphaTauri had from the beginning of the year, the car steps up its performance by a reasonable amount. So I think if I was Adrian Newey, I would feel a bit sort of there's a few knives there heading my direction, just because the fact that Mercedes don't accept that competition is competition, and they want to find fault in somebody else just because they're doing better. Again, it's one of those sort of situations where sometimes you have to look at yourself before you start, you know, pointing the finger at everybody else. And I think it's degrading for the championship for that to be happening, because it makes people feel bad about the racing in its own little way, because the viewer doesn't understand. The viewer just looks and thinks, well, I've heard that they're cheating, you know, and that's not correct. That's not if suddenly Ferrari introduced these engine parts, as the new engine parts for the next two races, and they're 20 k's quicker on the straight than anybody else in their own pole, and win the races, everybody would be saying, oh, you know, it's well done Ferrari, or would you be saying they've got to be cheating? You know, that's wrong. There's competitions there, and you've got to go and join that competition. And as I say, Mercedes have been there since 2014, right at the front of the show. So I think it's wrong to degrade anybody else that's doing a good job now.
Mark, do you think this is just the consequence of when we have a really close battle between a couple of teams at the front? It always, or often at least, tends to go this way, doesn't it? We've seen it in the past between Ferrari and McLaren, all sorts of kind of dueling teams. When it's so tight, they're just looking for everything, aren't they? And, you know, we've seen Red Bull slightly embarrass themselves with their review attempt, didn't they? It didn't make them look particularly good. And you've sort of got examples of both Mercedes and Red Bull perhaps not covering themselves in glory with some of their public pronouncements. Is that just what happens when everyone gets subjected to this season-long pressure cooker environment?
I think so, yeah. I think it gets antagonistic. It's unusual if it's a very close title fight for it not to get antagonistic. And I call it competitive paranoia creeps in, and it's what Gary was talking about there, where you're thinking, well, we can't do that, so how have they been able to do it? So one side triggers the other into doing it, and it sort of all just sort of flares up into this big sort of fairly unpleasant sort of vibe. So yeah, it's not healthy, but it goes back a long way. I remember how antagonistic Ferrari and McLaren were in that 76 season where Gary was on McLaren. Working at McLaren at that time. So, yeah, it is just part of the sport, unfortunately.
There you go, Gary. Mark's implicating you in this now.
No, I was actually at Brabham at that point in time. But I know what you mean, Mark. But the thing it seems to be is, you know, Toto Wolff on many, many occasions have said, you know, we're working to the extreme. We're working, you know, absolutely flat out. We can't do any more. Well, so is everybody. That's the problem, isn't it? Everybody is working flat out within their own little set of circumstances, right down to the fact of Williams or Haas, or no matter what the team is, they're working within their little set of circumstances, absolutely flat out, to achieve what they're achieving. And if somebody finds that, you know, magic switch, then so be it. They're doing a great job. But, you know, compliment them on it. Say, oh, Red Bull have done a really good job this year, but we're still going to go for them and we're still going to beat them. It's a whole different way of putting it, you know, and because that's what Mercedes need to do. You know, if Red Bull have done a good job, so be it. Good. Well done, chaps. Now let us find that solution and just work harder.
Well, it's going to be interesting to see how it goes in the second half of the season, whether they go with that more sporting approach or whether they get more wound up by the competitive paranoia. I think it's going to be one of those ones that runs and runs. But the fact is, it's the stopwatch and what happens on track that decides it. That's the great thing about motorsports. Well, thanks to Gary and Mark for your insight. Do head to therace.com and don't forget the hyphen for more from Mark, Gary and the rest of the team. And if you need some more podcasts to fill in the August break, it's well worth checking out Bring Back V10s, which delves into classic F1 stories. The latest episode is all about Nigel Mansell's return with Williams in 1994. That features Karin Chandhok, and I think Gary and Mark were just recording a future episode to Bring Back V10, so they'll be turning up there in a later episode as well. Do stay with us on the Race F1 podcast, as we'll be back soon with everything you need to know as F1 prepares to come back to life next week ahead of the Belgian Grand Prix.
Looking for the best place to buy tickets for any of your favorite teams or sporting events? We've got the spot. Our partner, StubHub, has been the leading ticket marketplace in the world for over 20 years, providing a 100% guarantee with every order. From a worldwide selection of live events, the widest choice of tickets and industry-leading partnerships, StubHub has what you need to purchase with confidence. StubHub, an official partner of The Athletic.